Harry Rex studied the legals with a magnifying glass to keep abreast of the news and gossip. Jake usually just scanned them. But he had not ignored Stuart Cofer's property. The county assessed the house and 10 acres at $115,000, and there were no mortgages or liens. The title was free and clear, and all potential creditors had 90 days from July 2nd to file claims against the estate. Cofer had been dead for over 3 months, and Jake wondered what took so long, though such a delay was not unusual. State law provided no deadline to open probate. He thought of at least two possible lawsuits, one filed on behalf of Josie for her medical bills, now in excess of $20,000, but the debt collectors couldn't find her. The second could be filed on behalf of Kira for child support. And he could not forget his own lawsuit against Cecil Cofer for the beating and the bills it created, only half of which were covered by Jake's no-frills health insurance policy. But suing the Cofers at this point could be counterproductive. His sympathy for the family had dissipated in the Kroger parking lot, but they had suffered enough. For now, he would wait until after Drew's trial and reassess the situation. The last thing he needed was more bad press. Lucian be damned. Chapter 38. Beginning in early July, as soon as Jake was physically able, Judge Noose began appointing him to indigent criminal cases throughout the 22nd District. It was not unusual for a lawyer from one county to handle cases next door, and Jake had done so throughout his career. The local lawyers did not complain, because most of them did not want the work to begin with. The pay was not great, $50 an hour, but at least it was guaranteed. And it was common practice throughout the state to pad the indigent files with a few extra hours to cover time spent driving from one courthouse to another. Noose even bunched Jake's cases together so that the 90-minute trip to the town of Temple in Milburn County would be somewhat profitable when four new defendants were hauled into court for their initial appearances. Jake was soon running down to Smithfield in Polk County and to the crumbling Van Buren County Courthouse outside the town of Chester, Noose's home. He was appointed to every indigent case in Ford County. He suspected, but of course could never prove, that Chancellor Reuben Attlee had intervened with one of his judges-only chats and whispered to Noose something to the effect of, "You stuck him with Gamble, now help him out." 2 weeks before the Gamble trial, Jake was in Gretna, seat of Tyler County, handling the first appearances of three freshly indicted car thieves, with Lowell Dyer representing the state. After a long morning grinding the wheels of justice, Judge Noose called them both to the bench and said, "Gentlemen, let's have lunch together in chambers. We have things to discuss." Since Dyer's office was just down the hall, he asked his secretary to order sandwiches. Jake asked for egg salad, the easiest to chew. When the food arrived, they took off their jackets, loosened their ties, and started eating. "In the Gamble matter, gentlemen, what's pending?" Noose knew exactly what matters needed to be decided before trial, but the meeting was informal and off the record, so he let the lawyers choose the impromptu agenda. Jake said, "Well, venue for one." Noose said, "Yes, and I'm inclined to agree with you, Jake. It might be difficult to pick an impartial jury in Clanton. I'm changing venue. Lowell?" "Judge, we've filed our objection and supporting affidavits. There's nothing else to say." "Good. I've been fully briefed and I've thought about it for a long time." "And you've also had an earful from Judge Attlee," Jake thought. "We'll try the case in Chester," Noose declared. For the defense, any venue other than Clanton was a win. But trying the case in the dilapidated Van Buren County courthouse was not much better. Jake nodded and tried to appear pleased. An August trial in that dusty old courtroom with a packed house would be like slugging it out in a sauna. He almost wished he hadn't howled for a change of venue. Polk County had a modern courthouse with toilets that actually flushed. Why not there? And Milburn County Courthouse had just been renovated. "It may not be your favorite courtroom," Noose said, stating the obvious, "but I'll get it spruced up. I've already ordered some new window units to keep things cool." The only way to improve Noose's favorite courtroom was to burn it. What a challenge it would be to examine witnesses over the din of straining AC units. Noose went on trying to justify a decision based more on the comfort of the judge than the convenience of the litigants. "The trial is 2 weeks away, and I'll have the place ready." Jake suspected his honor wanted to shine in front of his home folks. Whatever. The slight advantage was Jake's, but the state could try the case anywhere and still have the upper hand.
"We'll be ready," Dyer said. "I'm concerned about the psychiatric expert for the defense, Your Honor. We've asked twice for his name and resume and have received nothing."
Jake said, "I'm not going with insanity, and I'm withdrawing the McNaughton notice." Dyer was startled and blurted,
"Couldn't find an expert?"
"Oh, there are plenty of experts, Lowell," Jake said coolly. "Just a change in strategy." Noose was surprised, too.
"When did you decide this?"
"Within the past few days." They ate for a moment and considered this.
"Well, that should make the trial even shorter," Noose said, obviously pleased.
Neither side wanted a war over expert testimony that few jurors could grasp. Insanity was used in less than 1% of all criminal trials, and though it rarely worked for the defense, it never failed to stir strong emotions and confuse juries.
"Any more surprises, Jake?" Lowell asked.
"Not at this time."
"I don't like surprises, gentlemen," Noose said.
Dyer said, "Well, Judge, there's an important matter still hanging in the air, and it's no surprise to anyone.
It seems patently unfair to the state to allow this trial to turn into a slander campaign against the victim, a fine officer of the law who cannot be there to defend himself. There will be allegations of physical abuse, even sexual abuse, and we have no way of knowing the truth about these claims. The only three witnesses are Josie Gamble and her two children, assuming Drew will be a witness, which I doubt. But these three will have the opportunity to say virtually anything about Stuart Kofa. How am I supposed to get to the truth?"
"They'll be under oath," Noose said.
"Sure they will, but they'll have every motive known to man to exaggerate, even lie and fabricate. Drew will be on trial for his very life, and I don't doubt for a second that he and his mother and sister will paint a nasty portrait of the victim. It is simply not fair."
Jake deftly opened a file and withdrew two enlarged color photos of Josie lying in the hospital bed with her face swollen and bandaged. He slid one across the table to Dyer and handed the other to his honor. "Voila," he asked. "This speaks for itself." Dyer had already seen the photographs.
"You plan to offer this in evidence?"
"I certainly do, when she testifies.
I'll object to the jury seeing this one and the others."
"Object all you want, but you know they'll be admitted."
"I'll make that decision at trial," Noose said, reminding them of who was in charge. "And what about the girl?" Dyer asked. "I assume she'll testify that she was sexually assaulted by Kofa."
"Correct. She was repeatedly raped."
"But how do we know? Did she tell her mother? Did she tell anyone?" We know she didn't call the authorities. That was because Kofor threatened to kill her if she did. Dyer threw up his hands and said, "See, Judge, how do we know she was raped?" "Just wait," thought Jake. "You'll find out soon enough." Dyer went on, "It's just not fair, Judge. They can say anything they want about Stuart Kofor, and we have no way to counter." "The facts are the facts, Lowell," Jake said. "They were living a nightmare and were afraid to tell anyone. That's the truth, and we can't hide it or change it." "I want to talk to the girl," Dyer said. "I have the right to know what she'll say on the stand, assuming I'm forced to call her as a witness. If you don't call her, I will." "Where is she?" "I'm not at liberty to say." "Come on, Jake. Are you hiding another witness?" Jake took a deep breath and held his tongue. Noose showed them his palms and said, "We're not gonna bicker, gentlemen. Jake, do you know where they are?" Jake glared at Dyer and said, "Cheap shot." He looked at Noose and said, "I do, and I'm sworn to secrecy, Your Honor. They're not far away, and they'll be in court when the trial starts." "Are they hiding?" "You could say that, yes. After I was attacked, they were rattled and left the area. Who can blame them? That plus Josie has bill collectors hounding her, so she's gone underground. Nothing new for her, really, because she's been running most of her life. She's moved around more than the three of us combined. They'll be in the courtroom when the trial starts, I guarantee it. They will be witnesses, and they have to be there for Drew." "I'd still like to talk to her," Dyer said. "You've done that twice already. Both times in my office, you asked me to make them available, and I did." "Are you going to put the defendant on the stand?" Dyer asked. "Don't know yet," Jake said with a sappy smile, because he didn't have to answer the question. "I'll wait and see how the trial goes." Noose took a bite of his sandwich and chewed for a while. "I don't like the idea of putting the deceased on trial. However, there was obviously a violent encounter with the mother just moments before he died. There are allegations of abuse of the children and threats to keep them silent. Taken as a whole, I see no way to keep this from the jury. I'd like you to submit briefs on this issue, and we'll talk again before the trial." They had already submitted briefs and had nothing to add. Noose was stalling and looking for a way to avoid a tough decision. "Anything else?" he asked. "What about the list of potential jurors?" Jake asked. "It will be faxed to your respective offices at 9 a.m. next Monday. I'm working on it now. We purged our voter registration rolls last year at my direction, and this county is in good shape. We'll summon about 100 for jury selection, and I'm warning both of you to stay away from the pool. Jake, as I recall, there were a lot of rumors about contact with the pool in the Haley trial." "Not by me, Your Honor. Rufus Buckley was out of control, and the prosecution was stalking people." "Whatever. This is a small county, and I know most of the people. If anyone is contacted, I'll hear about it."
"But we can conduct our basic investigations, right, Judge?" Dyer asked. "We have the right to gather as much background as possible."
"Yes, but no direct contact." Jake was already thinking about Harry Rex and wondering who he might know in Van Buren County. And Gwen Haley, Carly's wife, was from Chester and had grown up not far from the courthouse. And years ago, Jake had handled a land dispute for a nice family out in the county and won it. And Morris Finley, one of the few lawyers left in Chester, was an old friend. Across the table, Lowell Dyer was having similar thoughts. In the race to dig up dirt on the potential jurors, he would have the upper hand because Ozzy would lean on the local sheriff, an old-timer who knew everybody. The race was on. Leaving the courthouse in Gretna, Jake called Harry Rex and told him the trial would be in Chester. Harry Rex cursed and said, "Why that dump?"
That's the question of the day. Probably because Noose wants a trial in his backyard so he can go home for lunch. Get busy.
He had just crossed into Ford County when a red warning light next to his odometer began flashing. His engine was losing power, and he stopped in front of a country church without another car in sight. It had finally happened. He and his beloved 1983 Saab had traveled 270,000 miles together, and their journey had finally come to an end. He called the office and asked Porsche to send a tow truck. He sat on the shaded steps of the church for an hour and stared at his most cherished possession. It had been the coolest in town when he bought it new in Memphis after settling a workers' comp case. The fee went for the down payment, but the monthly notes had stretched on for 5 years. He should have traded it in 2 years earlier when he had cash from the Hubbard Will contest, but he didn't want to spend the money, nor did he want to part with the only red Saab in the county. But the repair bills had become outrageous because no mechanic in Clanton would touch the damn thing. Service required an all-day trip to Memphis, something he would not miss. The car attracted too much attention. He had been easy to spot driving away from Stan's that night when Mike Nesbitt pulled him over and almost charged him with DUI. And he had no doubt that his beating at Kroger had been facilitated by the fact that the red Saab was easy to follow. The tow truck driver's name was BC, and Jake sat in the cab with him after he hitched up his car and they drove away. Jake had never been a passenger in a tow truck before. "Mind if I ask what BC stands for?" he asked, loosening his tie. BC had a mouthful of tobacco, and he spat in an old Pepsi bottle.
"Battery charger."
"I like it. How'd you get tagged with battery charger?"
"Well, when I was a kid, I liked to steal batteries out of cars. I'd take them to Mr. Orville Gray's service station, sneak in at night, charge them real good, then sell them for $10. Clear profit, no overhead."
"You ever get caught?"
"Nope. I was too slick. But my buddies knew about it, and that's where the name came from. That's a weird car back there, if I say so."
"It certainly is."
"Where do you get it fixed?"
"Not around here. Let's take it to the Chevrolet place." At Goff Motors, Jake paid BC $100 in cash and gave him several business cards. With a grin, Jake said, "Pass these out at the next car wreck." BC knew the game and asked,
"What's my cut?"
10% of the settlement.
"I like it."
He stuffed the cash and cards in his pocket and drove away. Jake looked down a row of shiny new Impalas and eyed a gray one with four doors. By the time he looked at the sticker, a smiling salesman appeared from nowhere and stuck out a friendly hand. They went through the usual ritual, and Jake said, "I'd like to trade in my old car." He nodded at the Saab.
"What is it?"
asked the salesman. 1983 Saab with a lot of miles.
"I think I've seen that around town. What's the trade-in value?"
$5,000 and change. He frowned and said,
"That may be a bit high."
"Can I get this financed through General Motors?"
"I'm sure we can work something out."
"I'd like to stay away from the banks around here."
"No problem."
Laden with even more debt, Jake drove away an hour later in a leased Impala, gray in color, and one that blended in nicely with the traffic. It was a good time for him to be inconspicuous. Chapter 39. At 9 a.m. Monday, Jake and Portia were standing at the fax machine drinking coffee and waiting anxiously for the jury list from Judge Noose. 10 minutes later, it arrived. 3 sheets of paper with 97 names in alphabetical order. Name, address, age, race, gender, nothing else.
There was no standard form for the publication of the jury pools, and it varied throughout the state. Not surprisingly, Jake did not recognize a single name. Van Buren County had 17,000 people, the smallest population of any of the five in the 22nd Judicial District. And in his 12 years as a lawyer, Jake had spent almost no time there. There had been no reason to. Not for the first time. He asked himself if he had made a mistake in insisting on a change of venue. At least in Ford County, he would recognize a few of the names. Harry Rex would know even more. Portia made 10 copies, took one with her, said goodbye, and headed for the courthouse in Chester, where she would spend the next 3 days poring over the public records for land transactions, divorces, wills, vehicle loans, and criminal charges. Jake faxed one copy to Harry Rex and one to Hal Fremont, a lawyer buddy across the square who had moved to Clanton a few years back when his practice in Chester dried up. He faxed another copy to Morris Finley, the only lawyer he knew in Van Buren County. At 10, he met with Darrell and Rusty, two brothers who worked as Clanton City policemen and moonlit as private investigators. As was typical in small jurisdictions, the city police played second fiddle to the county sheriff's department, and there was no love lost between the two forces. Darrell knew Stuart Cofer in passing. Rusty did not. It didn't matter. For $50 an hour each, they were happy to get the work. Jake gave them the list and firm instructions not to get noticed as they snooped around Van Buren County. They were expected to find and photograph, if possible, the homes, vehicles, and neighborhoods of the potential jurors. When they left, Jake mumbled to himself, "They'll probably make more off this case than me." The small wood war room downstairs had been converted to the makeshift headquarters for the Gamble jury. On one wall, there was a large map of the county, and on it, Jake and Portia had marked every church, school, highway, county road, and country store. Another large map laid out the city streets of Chester. Working from the list, Jake began locating as many of the addresses as possible and memorizing names. He could almost envision the jury. White, with maybe two or three blacks, hopefully more women than men, average age of 55, rural, conservative, religious. Booze could be a big factor in the trial. Van Buren was still a dry county, and fiercely so. Its last liquor vote was in 1947, and the drinkers lost in a landslide. Since then, the Baptists had squelched any efforts to have another election. Each county controlled its liquor laws, and half the state was still dry. As always, the bootleggers did a brisk business in the parched areas, but Van Buren had a reputation as the home of serious teetotalers. How would these sober folks react to the testimony that Stuart Cofer was a raging drunk the night he died? That there was enough alcohol in his blood to practically kill him? That he had spent the afternoon drinking beer and then topped it off with illegal moonshine as he and his friends blacked out? The jurors would certainly be shocked and disapproving. But they would also be conservative enough to love the men in uniform. Killing an officer called for the death penalty, a punishment revered in those parts. At noon, Jake left town and drove 20 minutes to a lumber mill deep in the county. He saw Carl Lee Haley eating a sandwich with his men in the shade of a small pavilion and waited in his new car, which was not recognizable. When they finished lunch, Jake walked over and said, "Hello." Carl Lee was surprised to see him and at first thought there might be some trouble. Jake explained what he was after. He gave Carl Lee a list of the jurors and asked him and Gwen to study the names and quietly ask around. Most of her large family still lived in Van Buren County.
and not far from Chester. "This ain't illegal, is it?" he asked, flipping a page.
"Would I ask you to do something illegal, Carly?"
"Probably not."
"This is pretty typical stuff in a jury trial. You sure can believe we did it for yours."
"Something worked," Carly said with a laugh.
He flipped another page and stopped laughing.
"Jake, this guy here is married to Gwen's cousin on her daddy's side."
"His name?"
"Rodney Coat. Know him pretty well. He was in the courtroom for my trial."
Jake was thrilled, but tried not to show it.
"Is he a reasonable man?" "What does that mean?"
"It means, can you talk to him? On the sly, you know, off the record, over a beer." Carly smiled and said,
"I get it."
They were walking to Jake's car.
"What's this?" Carly asked.
"A new set of wheels."
"What happened to that funky little red thing?"
"It quit."
"About time."
Jake was elated as he drove back to town. With luck and perhaps a bit of coaching from Carl Lee, Rodney Coat could survive the barrage of qualifying questions to be thrown at the pool during selection. Was he related to Drew Gamble? Obviously not. Did he know anyone in the defendant's family? No. No one knew the Gambles. Did he know the deceased? No. Did he know any of the lawyers for either the prosecution or defense? Here, Rodney would have to be careful. Though he had never met Jake, he certainly knew who he was, which in itself would not disqualify him. In small towns, it was inevitable that potential jurors knew some of the lawyers. Rodney should remain silent here. "Mr. Braganza over there is involved in the private practice of law. He ever do any business for you or anyone in your family?" Again, Rodney should not raise his hand. Jake had represented Carl Lee, not Gwen. Being married to a non-blood relative was not close enough to warrant further examination. At least, not in Jake's opinion. Jake was suddenly obsessed with getting Rodney Coat on the jury. But he would need some luck. Next Monday, when they first arrived in the courtroom, the jurors would be seated at random, not alphabetically. Each would get a number pulled from a hat. If Rodney was in the first 40 or so, he stood a good chance of making the final 12 with some skillful manipulation by Jake. A high number meant he would not make it. The problem would be Willie Hastings, Gwen's cousin on her mother's side, and the first black deputy hired by Sheriff Walls. Ozzie was undoubtedly already working for the prosecution, polling his deputies, and if Willie spoke up about Rodney Coat, then he would be struck for good cause. Perhaps Ozzie might not quiz Hastings. Perhaps Hastings didn't know Coat, but that was unlikely. Jake almost turned around for another chat with Carl Lee, but decided to do it later. Soon, though. By Wednesday, the walls of the jury room were covered with more maps and more names stuck to the maps with colored pushpins. Dozens of enlarged photos were tacked to the maps, photos of cars and old pickups, tidy homes in towns and trailers in the country, farmhouses, churches, gravel driveways with no homes in sight, small stores where people worked, and low-wage factories that produced shoes and lamps. The average household in the county earned $31,000 a year, barely enough to survive, and the photos told the tale. Prosperity had bypassed Van Buren County, and its population was declining, a sad trend that was not unusual in rural Mississippi. Harry Rex had tracked down 7 names. Morris Finley added another 10. Hal Fremont recognized only a few names on the list. As small as the county was, trying to pinpoint 97 names out of 17,000 was still an uphill battle. Darrell and Rusty had managed to procure 11 church directories, and these revealed the names of 21 prospective jurors. There were at least 100 churches, though, and most were too small
to print the names of their members. Portia was still digging through the public records, but had found little of value. Four of the prospects had divorced in the last 10 years. One bought a 200-acre tract of land the year before. Two had been arrested for drunk driving. How this gossip was supposed to help was lost on the team. By Thursday, Jake and Portia were playing the name game as they worked. He picked a name from the list, announced it, and from memory, she either rattled off what little info they had or admitted they had nothing. Then she picked a name, and from memory, he spouted the person's age, race, gender, and anything else they had learned. They worked late into the nights, combing their data, nicknaming the jurors, and memorizing everything. The selection process could be slow and tedious, but there would also be moments when Jake would need to react quickly, saying yes or no after only a moment's reflection, before moving on to the next prospect. Because it was a capital case, Noose would be in no hurry. He might even allow the lawyers to meet privately with a person on the list to probe even deeper. Each side would have 12 peremptory challenges or rejections for no cause at all. If Jake didn't like the sneer on a person's face, he could cut her for no reason. These, though, were valuable and had to be used with great discretion. Any juror could be challenged for cause. If your husband was a police officer, so long. If you were related to the victim, hit the door. If you could not consider a death verdict, bye-bye. If you had been the victim of domestic violence, it was best if you didn't serve. The fiercest fights were always over who to cut for cause. If the judge agreed that a person might not be impartial for a reason, then he dismissed him or her without burning either side's peremptory challenges. It had been Jake's experience that most people, once they were subpoenaed and had gone to the trouble of showing up for selection, actually wanted to serve on the jury. This was especially true in the more rural areas where trials were rare and offered a little drama. However, when the death penalty was in play, virtually no one wanted to get near the jury box. The longer he looked at the list, the more he became convinced that he could throw darts at it and take any 12, as long as he got Rodney Coates. Harry Rex thundered in Friday afternoon and said they needed a break. Portia was exhausted, and Jake sent her home. He locked his office and insisted on driving. He and Harry Rex climbed into his shiny new Impala and, without stopping for beer, drove to Chester for a bit of recon. Along the way, they argued trial strategy and scenarios. Harry Rex had become convinced that Noose would probably declare a mistrial when Kira told the jury who had impregnated her, assuming that Dyer was caught off guard. Jake disagreed, though he was not completely confident he could pull off the ambush. At some point Monday morning, probably before they began jury selection, Dyer would want to meet with Kira to go over her testimony once again. She was over 7 months pregnant, and that would be impossible to conceal. They discussed putting Drew on the witness stand. Jake had spent hours with him and was still not sure the kid could withstand a brutal cross-examination. Harry Rex was adamant in his belief that the defendant should never testify. It was Friday, and the courthouse was clearing out. They removed their coats and ties and made it upstairs to the courtroom without being noticed. Inside, they were surprised to feel cool air. Noose's new window units were running at full speed and not making much noise. They would probably work overtime through the weekend. The courtroom had been cleaned thoroughly, not a speck of dust or dirt anywhere. Two painters were hard at work adding a fresh coat of white enamel while another was on his knees brushing the woodwork around the bench with a new finish.
"Well, I'll be damned," Harry Rex mumbled. "This place has never looked so good."
The faded oil portraits of dead judges and politicians had been removed, no doubt sent to the basement where they belonged, and the bare walls gleamed with shiny new paint. The ancient pews had been refinished. 12 new chairs with comfortable cushions were in the jury box. The large overhanging balcony had been cleared of neglected filing cabinets and storage boxes, replaced with 2 rows of rented chairs.
"Noose is spending some money on the place," Jake whispered. "About time. I guess it's his big moment, too. Looks like he's expecting a crowd."
They had no desire to see the judge, and after a few minutes, headed for the door. Jake stopped for another look and realized that his stomach was in knots. Before his first jury trial, Lucian had said,
"If you're not nervous as hell when you walk into that courtroom, then you're not ready."
Before the Haley trial, Jake had locked himself in a toilet next to the jury room and vomited. Down the hallway, Harry Rex stepped into a restroom. He emerged moments later and said,
"Well, I'll be damned. The commodes are actually flushing. Looks like old Ichabod has really cracked the whip around here."
They left the town and headed east, in no hurry to go anywhere. When they crossed into Ford County, Jake stopped at the first country store, and Harry Rex went in to buy a 6-pack. They drove to Lake Chatula and found a picnic table under a shade tree on a bluff, a hiding place both had visited in the past, together and alone. Chapter 40. Monday, August 6th. Jake slept in short little naps interrupted by long stretches of wide-eyed worries about all the things that could go wrong. His dream was to become a great trial lawyer. But as always on the first morning, he asked himself why anyone would want the stress. The meticulous pretrial preparation was tedious and nerve-wracking, but nothing compared to the actual battle. In the courtroom and in front of the jury, a lawyer has at least 10 things on his mind, all crucial. He must concentrate on the witness, either his or an opponent's, and hear every word of the testimony. Should he object, and why? Has he covered all of the facts? Are the jurors listening, and if so, do they believe the witness? Do they like the witness? If they're not paying attention, is this beneficial or not? He must observe every move made by his opponent and predict where he is going. What is his strategy? Has he changed mid-course, or is he laying a trap? Who was the next witness, and where was she or he? If the next witness was adverse, how effective would she be? If he was a defense witness, was he ready? Actually in the courthouse and prepared? The absence of discovery in criminal trials only heightened the stress because the lawyers were not always certain what the witness might say. And the judge, was he on top of his game, listening, napping, hostile or friendly or neutral? Were the exhibits properly prepared and ready? Would there be a fight over their admission into evidence? And if so, did the lawyer know the rules of evidence inside and out? Lucian had lectured him on the importance of being relaxed, cool, calm, unflappable, regardless of how the trial was progressing. The jurors missed nothing, and every move made by the lawyer was noticed. Acting was important. Feigning disbelief at damaging testimony, showing compassion where needed, occasionally flashing anger when appropriate. But overacting could be devastating if it verged on phoniness. Humor could be lethal
because in tense situations, everyone needed a good laugh, but it was to be used rarely. A man's life was on the line, and a comment made too lightly could backfire. Watch the jurors constantly, but don't overdo it. Don't let them catch you trying to read them. Have all motions been properly filed? Were the jury instructions ready? The final summation was often the most dramatic moment, but preparing it ahead of time was difficult because the witnesses had not yet been heard. He had won the Haley acquittal with a stunning closing argument. Could he do it again? What magic words or phrases could he conjure up to save his client? His greatest moment would be ambushing the state with Kira's pregnancy, and he had lost hours of sleep thinking about it. How could he protect the secret that very morning in just a few hours, as all the players gathered in the crowded courtroom? He drifted away again and woke up from a moment of deep sleep to the distant aroma of frying bacon. It was 4:45, and Carla was at the stove. He said good morning, kissed her, poured coffee, and said he was taking a quick shower. They ate quietly at the breakfast nook, bacon and scrambled eggs with toast. Jake had eaten little over the weekend and had no appetite. She said, "I'd like to run through my plan again, if you don't mind." "Sure. You're basically babysitting. Nice to be so necessary. I assure you, your role is crucial. Let's hear it." "I'll meet Josie and Kira outside the courthouse at 10 and keep them in the hallway on the first floor. We'll wait there while the selection process begins. What am I supposed to do if Dyer wants to talk to them?" "Not sure. Dyer will have plenty on his mind first thing this morning. Like me, he'll be consumed with worry about the jury pool. But if he asks about Kira and Josie, I'll tell him they're on the way. Selection will drag on through the morning and probably the entire day, and I'll send instructions to you. If I get a break, I'll come find you. They're under subpoena, so they have to be close by.
And if Dyer finds us?"
"He has the right to talk to Kira, not Josie. He probably realized she's pregnant, but I doubt he'll have the guts to ask who's the father. Keep in mind, the only thing Dyer wants from her is the testimony that Drew shot Kofa. He has to have that, and I doubt he'll go much further."
"I can do this,"
she said nervously. "Sure you can. There will be a crowd swarming around the courthouse, so just try to get lost in it. At some point, I'll want you in the courtroom as we narrow the pool and start picking the 12.
"And what am I supposed to do in the courtroom, exactly?"
"Study the jurors, especially those on the first four rows, especially the women." After a few bites, he said, "Gotta go. I'll see you over there."
"You need to eat, Jake."
"I know, but I'll probably lose it anyway." He kissed her on the cheek and left the house. In his car, he removed a pistol from his briefcase and hid it under the seat. He parked in front of his office, unlocked the door, and turned on the lights. Portia arrived half an hour later, and at 7, Libby Provine made her entrance in a tight pink designer dress, high heels, and a loud paisley scarf. She had arrived in Clanton late Sunday afternoon, and they had worked until 11. "You look rather smashing," Jake observed with reservations.
"You like it?"
she shot back. "I don't know. It's pretty bold. I doubt if we'll see another pink dress in the courtroom today."
"I like to be noticed, Jake," she sang in her best Scottish brogue. "I know it's rather non-traditional, but I found that jurors, especially the men, like a bit of fashion amongst all the dark suits. You look quite handsome."
"Thanks, I guess. My newest lawyer suit." Portia kept staring at the pink dress. Libby said,
"Just wait till they hear me talk.
They probably won't understand a word." She wouldn't be talking much, not at first. Her role was to assist Jake during the guilt or second phase of the trial and say little until then. If Drew were convicted of capital murder,
She would play a bigger role in the war over his sentencing. Dr. Thane Sedgwick was on standby at Baylor in case he was needed to sprint over to try and save the kid's life. Jake was praying that would not be necessary, but he expected it. He didn't have time to worry about it that morning. Jake looked at her and said, "Tell me about Luther Redford." Libby shot back, "White male, age 62, lives in the country on Pleasant Valley Road, raises organic chickens and sells them to the best restaurants in Memphis. Married for 40 years to the same woman, 3 adult children scattered, a bunch of grandchildren, Church of Christ."
"And what does Church of Christ mean?"
"Devout, clannish, conservative, fundamental, strong on law and order, with a dim view of violent crime. Almost certainly a teetotaler with no use at all for alcohol and drunkenness."
"Would you take him?"
"Probably not, but he might be on the cusp. We defended a 17-year-old 2 years ago in Oklahoma, and the defense lawyer avoided all Church of Christ members, as well as a lot of Baptist and Pentecostals.
And?"
"Guilty. It was an awful crime. But we hung the jury on sentencing and got life without parole, which is supposed to be a win, I guess."
"Would you take him, Portia?"
"No."
"We can play this game driving over. How many jurors are complete mysteries?"
17, Portia said.
"That's a lot. Look, I'll load the car while the two of you go through the hit list of all jurors we will challenge for cause."
"We've already done that at least twice," Portia said. "I have the list memorized."
"Memorize it again."
Jake left the office, went downstairs, and loaded 3 large document boxes into the trunk of his Impala, which had far more space than the old Saab. At 7:30, the defense team left Clanton with Portia behind the wheel and Jake in the back seat, calling off the names of people they had never seen but were about to meet. Josie parked at the jail and told Kira to stay in the car. Lying neatly on the rear seat was a navy blazer, white shirt, clip-on tie, and gray slacks, all arranged carefully on a hanger. Josie retrieved the outfit, which she had put together in the past week, browsing through discount stores in and around Oxford. Jake had given her strict instructions on what to buy, and she had spent the previous day washing and ironing Drew's trial ensemble. The shoes didn't matter, Jake had said. He wanted his client to look nice and respectful, but not too preppy. Drew's secondhand sneakers would do just fine. Mr. Zack was waiting at the jail desk, and he led her down the hall to the juvenile cell.
"He's had his shower, but he didn't want to,"
he said quietly as he unlocked the door. Josie stepped in, and he closed the door behind them. The defendant was sitting at his table playing solitaire. He stood and hugged his mother and noticed her red eyes.
"Are you crying again, Mom?"
he asked. She did not reply, but laid his outfit on the bottom bunk. On the top bunk, she noticed an untouched tray of eggs and bacon and asked,
"Why haven't you eaten?" "Not hungry, Mom. I guess this is my big day, huh?" "It is. Let's get dressed. I gotta wear all that." "Yes, sir. You going to court and you gotta look nice, like Jake said. Let me have the overalls."
No 16-year-old boy wanted to strip in front of his mother, regardless of the circumstances. But Drew knew he couldn't complain. He stepped out of the orange jail garb as she handed him the slacks first.
"Where'd you get this stuff?"
he asked, taking them and quickly pulling them on.
"Here and there. You gotta wear this every day, Jake's orders." "How many days, Mom? How long will this take?" "Most of the week, I think."
She helped him into his shirt and buttoned it for him. He stuffed in the shirt tail and said,
"It feels a little too big." "Sorry, it's the best we can do."
She picked up the tie, clipped it over the top button, fussed with it, and said,
"When's the last time you wore a tie?"
He shook his head and wanted to complain, but why bother?
"I've never worn one." "Didn't think so. You're going to be in the courtroom with lots of lawyers and important people, and you need to look nice, okay? Jake said the jury will look you over, and appearances are important. He wants me to look like a lawyer? No. He wants you to look like a fine young man, and don't stare at the jurors. I know. I've read his instructions 100 times. Sit straight, pay attention, don't show emotion. If I get bored, scribble something on some paper.
The entire family had pages of written instructions from their lawyer. She helped him into the navy blazer, another first, and stepped back to admire him.
You look great, Drew. Where's Kira? Outside in the car. She's doing fine.
She was not. She was a wreck, same as her mother. 3 lost souls about to enter a lion's den, with no idea what was about to happen to any of them. She tousled his mop of blonde hair and wished she had a pair of scissors. Then she grabbed him and squeezed him fiercely and said,
I'm so sorry, baby. I'm so sorry. I got us into this mess. It's all my fault. All my fault.
He stood stiff as a board and waited for the moment to pass. When she finally released him, he looked at her moist eyes and said,
We've already talked about this, Mom. I did what I did, and I don't regret it. Don't say that, Drew. Don't say it now, and don't say it in court. Don't ever say that to anyone, you understand? I'm not stupid. I know you're not. What about my shoes? Jake said to wear your sneakers. Well, they don't really go with the rest of my outfit, do they? Just do as he says. Always, Drew, just do what he says. You look nice. And you'll be there, right, Mom? Of course I'll be there, on the front row right behind you.
Chapter 41. The prospective jurors began arriving at the old courthouse at 8:30. And they were greeted by the sight of 3 brightly painted news vans, one from the station in Tupelo, one from an affiliate in Jackson, one from Memphis. Crews were setting up lights and cameras as close to the front door as a deputy would allow them. The hamlet of Chester had never felt so important. The jurors, each holding a summons to validate their presence, were met at the front door by a polite clerk, who checked their paperwork, made an entry of some sort on the master list, and asked them to continue on up the stairs to the courtroom on the 2nd floor, where they would receive further instructions. The courtroom was locked and guarded by men in uniform, who asked them to wait a few minutes. A crowd soon gathered in the hallway as the nervous and curious jurors mingled and whispered. The summonses did not mention the matter at hand, but suspicions ran wild. Word soon spread that it was a criminal case involving a murdered deputy from over in Ford County. Harry Rex, wearing a John Deere cap and dressed like a rustic good old boy from the Hollows, and holding a sheet of paper that could pass for his own summons, mixed with the locals and listened to the gossip. He knew virtually no one from the area, and none of the jurors had ever laid eyes on him. But he nonetheless kept his guard up in case Lowell Dyer or anyone working for him ventured into the hallway. He chatted with a woman who said she had no time for jury duty and was needed at home to care for her aging mother. He overheard an older man say something to the effect that he had no qualms with the death penalty. He asked a younger woman if it was true that it was the case from Clanton where a deputy was murdered back in March. She said she didn't know, but seemed horrified at the prospect of sitting in judgment for such an awful matter. As the crowd thickened, he stopped talking and just listened, waiting for a stray word here or there that would reveal something crucial, something that might not be admitted in open court during the selection process. Spectators joined the jurors, and when Harry Rex saw the Kofers arrive, he eased into a restroom and lost the cap.
At 8:45, the door was opened, and a clerk asked those summoned to step into the courtroom and have a seat on the left side. They filed down the aisle, gawking at the vastness of the large, freshly painted room, a place few of them had ever seen. Another clerk pointed to the pews on the left. The right side would remain vacant for a while longer. Evidently, Noose had ordered the air conditioners to run at full speed throughout the weekend, and there was a noticeable chill in the air. August 6th, with a high of 95 expected, but oddly enough, the spruced-up courtroom was pleasant. Jake, Portia, and Libby stood around the defense table, whispering about important matters as they sized up the prospects. A few feet away, Lowell Dyer and D.R. Musgrove chatted with their investigator, Jerry Snook, as clerks and bailiffs milled about in front of the bench. Dyer stepped over and said to Jake,
"I assume Mrs. Gamble and her daughter are here."
"They'll be here, Lowell. I gave you my word."
"Did you give them their subpoenas?"
"I did."
"I'd like to chat with Cure at some point this morning."
"No problem."
Dyer was nervous and fidgety, obviously feeling the strain of his first big trial. Jake worked hard at appearing to be the seasoned veteran, but though he had more courtroom experience than his opponent, his stomach was in knots. Dyer didn't have a belt notched with big convictions, but he still had all the advantages handed to the state. Good over evil, law enforcement over the criminal, plenty of resources over an indigent defense. With Ozzy behind the wheel, the defendant arrived in the rear seat of the sheriff's clean and shiny patrol car. For the benefit of the press, it was parked in front of the courthouse where Ozzy and Moss Jr., grim-faced and all business, yanked open a rear door and removed the alleged killer. Handcuffed and ankle-chained, but reasonably well-dressed. They grabbed his skinny arms and walked him slowly in an old-fashioned perp march to the front door of the courthouse as the cameras clicked and rolled. Inside, they hustled him through a door that led to one of the building's many appendages and soon found the meeting room of the Van Buren County Board of Supervisors. A local deputy opened it for them, while saying to Ozzy,
"Got this place secured for you, Sheriff."
The room had no windows and not much in the way of air conditioning. Drew was told to sit in a certain chair, then left there as Ozzy and Moss Jr. stepped outside and closed the door. 3 hours would pass before it opened again. By 9:15, the pool was seated on one side. The other was still empty as the spectators waited in the hallway. A bailiff called court to order and asked everyone to rise. As they did, the Honorable Omar Noose appeared from a door behind the bench. The lawyers settled around their tables, and the clerks took their positions. Noose stepped down and walked to the bar, dividing the courtroom, his long black robe flowing behind him. Jake, seated only a few feet away, whispered to Libby,
"Oh no, it's the flowing robe routine."
She gave him a blank look. Occasionally, and especially when elections were looming, state trial judges liked to get closer to the masses, the voters, and greeted them not from a lofty perch on the bench, but down on the floor, at their level, from just behind the bar. Noose introduced himself to his home crowd and gave them a friendly welcome, thanking them for being there, as if they had a choice. He spent a moment rambling on about the importance of jury service to the orderly flow of justice. He hoped it would not be burdensome. Without going into detail, he described the nature of the case and explained that much of the day would be spent selecting a jury. He looked at a sheet of paper and said,
"I've been informed by the clerk that 3 members of this pool have failed to show."
Mr. Robert Giles, Mr. Henry Grant, and Mrs. Inez Bowen. All received proper subpoenas, but have not bothered to check in this morning. I'll ask the sheriff to round them up. He looked gravely at the sheriff seated near the jury box and nodded, as if prison might just be an option here. Now, we have 94 people here in the pool, and our first order of business is to see who might be exempt. If you're 65 or older, state law allows you to pass on jury service. Any volunteers for? Noose and the clerk had already called the seniors chosen from the voter registration records, but there were 8 in the pool between the ages of 65 and 70. He knew from experience that not all of those would claim the exemption. A man on the front row sprung up, waving his hand.
And you are? Harlan Winslow. I'm 68, and I got better things to do.
You're excused, sir. Winslow almost sprinted down the aisle. He lived deep in the country and had an NRA sticker on the bumper of his pickup. Jake happily struck his name. Good riddance. 3 others begged off and left the courtroom, down to 90. Noose said,
Next, we'll consider those with medical issues. If you have a note from your doctor, please step forward.
The pews creaked and rustled as a number of jurors stood and made their way forward, forming a line in the aisle in front of the judge. 11 in all. The first one, a slothful younger man who was morbidly obese, looked as though he might collapse at any moment. He handed over a note that Noose studied carefully before smiling and saying,
You are excused, Mr. Larry Sims.
He smiled and lumbered toward the door. As Noose methodically worked through the hardships, the lawyers studied their notes, scratched off names, and looked at the remaining members of the pool. 2 of the 11, with doctor's notes, were on Jake's list of complete mysteries, and he was pleased when they left. After 40 minutes of tedium, all 11 were gone, down to 79. Noose said,
Now, the rest of you are qualified to be examined during the selection process. We will do this by calling names at random. When you're called, please have a seat over on this side, beginning with the front row.
He waved to his left to the empty pews. A clerk stepped forward and handed him a small cardboard box, which he set on the defense table. This little lottery was the most crucial part of the selection process. The final 12 would likely come from the first 4 rows, the first 40 names pulled from the box. The lawyers quickly moved their chairs to the other side of their tables, facing the pool, their backs to the bench. Noose removed a folded strip of paper and called out,
Mr. Mark Mailer.
A man stood with great uncertainty and shuffled down the row to the aisle. Mailer, white male, age 48, longtime algebra teacher at the only high school in the county. 2 years at a junior college, degree in math from Southern Miss. Still married to his first wife, 3 children, the youngest still at home. Nice blazer, and one of the few neckties in the pool. First Baptist Church of Chester. Jake wanted him. As he sat at the far end of the front row, Noose called the name of Reba Delaney, white female, age 55, a housewife who lived in town and played the organ at the Methodist Church. She took a seat next to Mark Mailer. Number 3 was Don Coben, a 60-year-old farmer whose son was a policeman in Tupelo. Jake would challenge him for cause, and if that didn't work, he would burn a peremptory challenge to get rid of him. Number 4 was Mae Taggart, the first black chosen. She was 44 and worked at the Ford dealership. It was the collective wisdom of the defense team, including Harry Rex and Lucian, that blacks were preferred because they were more likely to have less sympathy for white officers. Dyer, though,
would be able to challenge them without the usual racial issues because both the defendant and the victim were white. After an hour on his feet, His Honor was feeling some strain in his lower back. When the first row was seated, he retired to the bench, to his comfortable chair with thick cushions. Jake studied the first 10. 2, he would definitely take. 3, he would not. The others would be argued over later. Noose reached into his box and pulled out the first name for the second row. Carla entered the courthouse at 10 and found the lobby filled with men in uniform. She said hello to Moss Jr. and Mike Nesbitt, and she recognized a few of the others. Jake had subpoenaed Ozzie's entire force. She eased away from them and walked to a first-floor annex where the county tax assessor had her office. Inside, sitting in plastic chairs and appearing to be completely overwhelmed, were Josie and Kira. They were delighted to see a friendly face and quick to hug her. They followed her out of the building and to her car. Once inside, she asked, "Have you talked to Jake this morning?" No, they had not.
"Haven't talked to anyone," Josie said. "What's going on?"
"Just jury selection. Probably last all day. How about some coffee?"
"Can we leave?"
"Sure. Jake said it's okay. Have you seen Mr. Dyer or anyone working for him?" Josie shook her head. They drove away and minutes later stopped on Main Street in Chester.
"Have you had breakfast?"
Carla asked.
"I'm starving,"
Kira blurted.
"I'm sorry.
Jake says this is the only cafe in town. Let's go." On the sidewalk, Carla got her first good look at Kira.